Welcome to the Fuck It Moments podcast. I'm your host, Claire Freeman. It's assumed bad luck to start a book by reading the last page, but I get the feeling that it might be best for this episode to let you hear the end of the story before we begin. I should say there are times in this episode where the F word is used along with a few of the noughties, plus the subjects we talk about might not be suitable for younger or sensitive ears. If so, pop your headphones on and listen in private. Today we meet an artist. He's called Jeffrey Knopf, and it's fair to say he's in a huge crossroads in his life right now. It's all because of something which happened just a few months ago. I think it's probably best if I let him explain in his own words.
You have to be terribly realistic when someone's very, very ill to the point that they're terminal. And we had to move. I moved back from Switzerland. I packed my house up. My wife, Tara, was already here getting some treatment. On the day that I moved back into my house, my wife, Tara, had arranged a meeting with her oncologist, who told her, you're terminal and your lifespan really for this is 3 months, 6 months, maybe a year. My wife outlived this by, she outlived it by 3 years. But that knocked me down. I remember coming home and my friend was here. He'd come over to help me unpack the house. I went upstairs to my bedroom and I sat on the bed and I just thought, what the fuck? What the fuck am I unpacking my house for? It's fucking shit. Why? Why? Why is this happening to us? What have I done in life? Have I been really that bad? Have I done something? And there's a lot of raw emotions that come with cancer. There's a lot of things. I can truly say that I suffered as much as my wife. I may not have had the physical manifestation that she had, but I had the mental manifestation. Every word that was said to me affected my moods. You go to all these meetings, you see the specialist and he tells you blah blah. Well, it affected my moods because my wife's mood would be changed. Tara was a fighter. She fought tooth and nail. She fought so hard. But it came with a cost. It came with a cost that I couldn't talk to Tara about certain things. I couldn't talk to her about things that were upsetting me or troubling me. You end up living with an elephant. That elephant's in your room all the time. And these cancer, as I said, at points in my life, control, identity, everything was taken away from me. Identity was taken away from me in this sense that, oh, there's Jeff. He's Tara's husband. She's the one with cancer. People would come up to me and say, hi, Jeff. How's Tara? No one ever says, how are you doing, Jeff? I had to. And what transpires is that you build an emotional wall around yourself. I've got this wall inside me. The only way I can describe it is it's a bit like the manifestation of the wall in Pink Floyd, The Wall. Mm. This wall, you box yourself off. You box off all your emotions. You box off everything. You become mentally ill, I think, in some ways. Because everything you're facing is so horrific. And even now, I find it hard to cry. I can't cry. I try. And there's times when I'm, you know, after my wife, when it was the funeral, I was in the right state. Since then, the only time I cry now is when I'm watching kids' movies. I always find something that just sets me off. My daughter will be sat there going, oh, did you see that film, Daddy? Yeah, it's awful. That's when wearing a mask comes into play. We all wear masks, all different sorts of masks. The mask, when you put a mask on, can create a lot of inhibition. That mask is also fuck it, because you can put the mask on and you can be someone totally different for that period of time.
And is that how you coped?
That's how I coped.
And so there you have it. The elephant in the room, as Jeff puts it. Fuck it, my wife died and I need to get back out there. I'll be honest that it bothered me for some days after interviewing Jeff. I felt angry at how cruel life can be at times. You know, why should a girl be left without a mum at such a young age, and how crap, putting it politely, it must have been to lose your identity and yourself, pausing your life for years, waiting for your wife to die. I do suspect that after you finish listening to this episode, it may be on your mind too for the next few days. But I also hope that you see what I saw on even the first time that I met Jeff, that there really is this true fuck it fighter spirit within all of us. It just takes a small spark to ignite it. For him, he says that was the day that we met as strangers. We sat next to each other in a coffee shop in December when I first introduced him to the fuck it moment way of life. But let's start by discovering life before death. Jeff, before his wife Tara and daughter Ruby were even on the scene.
Originally, Jeff was a free-thinking, fairly non-conformist character who solely thought about his art and his life, and fairly selfish in some ways, I would say, because being an artist, you become quite selfish and lost within your own head. And I've been in and out of relationships, and I decided I wanted to meet someone, and I met my late wife. You then find yourself conforming. You find yourself going, I need a job. I need to make money. I want to have certain things in life. I want to have a house. I want to have a car. I want this. I want that. So you end up entering into this rat race, as they call it. For me, it's never been an easy affair. I'm dyslexic, so I suffer with confidence issues. But again, there's fuck it moments in there. I think one of the best times I had was when I was living in London, and I decided I can't continue like this with no money. I know what, I'm going to go join an agency, and somehow ended up as a PA for a team that were working on what was called structural funding. And that was a fuck it moment, because it was one of those moments where I was totally out of my comfort zone, and I ended up, well, the first job was to ensure that a whole delegation of ministers from Europe and such like ended up at a destination for a big conference. Somehow I did that well, and I was able to stay on.
No pressure.
You know, someone that didn't know how to speak to people in foreign offices and stuff. And gradually it got to a point where I was ending up in ministerial offices and working with ministers, seeing things happen which we may call historical moments in life. But if I hadn't taken the bull by the horns at that point, I wouldn't know what working in an office would have been like. And I really had a great time, and I would have loved to become a civil servant at that point.
And how old were you at this point?
When I decided to settle down. I was about...
When you grew up.
When I grew up. Well, did I grow up? I don't know. I was about 30, I think it was about 32, 33. And then my wife, Tara, and I, we bought a house and we got married. And we then eventually had my daughter. And Then the fuck it moment came again. You're coasting along in this world, and then someone wakes up and says that she's found a lump. At which point your life is thrown upside down, inside out, and you really don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
For myself, it was that realization that, well, first of all, we wouldn't be able to have any more children, which was a big, wow, that's a fuck off. And then you realize as a man, you know, men want to fix things. I have my super glue, I have my Araldite, I have my gaffer tape, and if push come to shove, I have my very sticky back plastic double-sided stuff. But in this situation, none of these things can fix what's going on.
Tell me a bit about Tara. How did you guys meet, and what was it like, you know, in the early days before you grew up, as we decided to put it? You settled down, got a proper job, and had a child.
I had to grow up. Did I have to grow up?
You're still not grown up, it's okay.
I look in the mirror and I think, who's that old bugger? And in my head, I'm 20-something still. Well, our initial meeting was at a memorial stone setting for a friend's father. Tara was in the kitchen and I was floating about. I really didn't notice Tara then. No one introduced me to her. But she noticed me. I mean, you can't miss someone who's wearing a baseball cap and a Hawaiian shirt at such a solemn affair. But, you know, that's the way it is. It took us 2 years to finally be introduced to each other. And, again, I was phoned up by a friend and he said, here's this number, you need to ring it. So I rang the number. I left a long rambling message about, oh, I'm Jeff and blah, 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 blah. And I didn't leave a telephone number.
Oh, no!
So for days I was sat there thinking, wow, that's a bit of a bummer. Why did I do that? Why did I ring this person up? I've got no reply. She mustn't be interested. And then I thought, fuck it, I'll ring them back, pluck up the courage, and I rang back and I was told by her sister that, oh, you're the guy we've heard all about, you know, you didn't leave your telephone number.
So you're doing this on a house phone as well?
Yeah.
Oh no, that's scary when, like, the mum might pick up. What do you
Anyone?
Say then?
Who knows?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's what happened. We went out on a date. On the first date, I thought, right, I've got to be smarter. So I went out, bought myself some new clothes from Uniqlo that was in Manchester at the time. And I remember the date. It was in Fat Cats in Whitworth Street, is it? Yeah, at the docks area. And all I spoke about that night was flying kites and selling kites, because I was a kite salesman at that point. Who's a kite salesman? I am. I was so nervous, I was running backwards and forwards to the toilet. This was a big point in my life because, you know, being Jewish, and I'd never been out with a Jewish woman before. I'd just sort of... I always thought that most of the Jewish women I knew were pretty much princesses and weren't on my level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think outside the box. I'm not your conventional Jewish man, so...
We can tell that because you were a kite salesman.
Yeah, I mean, who does a thing like that? She must have seen something in me. I think it was the fact that I was tall and whatever. Not many Jewish guys are very tall. And... yeah, we had a few more dates and time went on and we ended up buying a house together. At which point, yes, you have to enter the real world and listen to Radio 4 on the radio whilst you're driving to some job that you really hate in life. And To get to this point, I'd actually stopped doing art for 5 years because I felt that I was a selfish person and that, and in many ways, my life was sometimes variable. It was my wife, my daughter, my art, my daughter, my wife, my art, my art, my art, my daughter, maybe my wife, my art, my art, my art. It just goes on like that. So Tara realised that I was deeply unhappy not doing art, and she helped push me back into the art, but that came with the caveat of me wanting to lose myself in the art all the time.
So you were kind of caught between these two worlds, really, of normality, but also escaping and being your creative self and being free to kind of do what you wanted, which is kind of a fuck it situation in yourself, isn't it? Because you're fighting with yourself constantly.
Totally, you're constantly fighting with yourself. You have no... I was the sort of person that was I felt guilty if I wasn't doing art.
Mm-hmm.
At times it drives me. At times it's my solace. At times it's my hideaway. Many people have things that drive them. Things drive you. You're driven to do music. You're driven to work with numbers or build things. I don't know whether you are driven to work with numbers.
Someone is
somewhere. But there's things that drive people. For me, the drive is art or creating or embellishing. At points in my life, it's all I've lived and breathed. I can't say I'm the greatest artist. I don't know. I never know how to class myself. But I just think, fuck it, I'll do it. A lot of the art projects that I do, yeah, they're fuck it moments.
Mm.
For a guy that was told he won't amount to much due to dyslexia, I've done quite a bit. I've painted billboards. I've done big murals. I've been in a band and had an self-produced album and done singles, and I always used to set myself targets and I expect their fuck-its. They're targets to see if I could do them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as an artist, you do have these fuck-it moments because you're constantly bearing yourself to people in the sense that if you choose to put your work into the public domain, whether it's on Instagram or in an exhibition, you have to stand there. You could walk away from it all and leave it, but I feel that I have to explain to people myself. If people don't enter into my world, how do they know what's going on?
Yeah. And you make yourself vulnerable that people might critique you and...
Yeah, you're very
not
vulnerable.
Like or not see the same perspective because that's the artwork. It is subjective.
That's it. I mean, I did the market. I had a little stall on Altrincham Market. And I remember one day some woman stood there flicking through my artwork going, don't like it, don't like it, don't like it, don't like it, don't like it. This went on for 10 minutes. At which point I got fairly annoyed and turned around and said, excuse me, madam, it's clear that this art isn't aimed at your demographic.
Yeah.
And do you mind moving on? Because you're now getting me to a point where I'm feeling a bit annoyed.
That was a very polite way to put that.
That is a very polite way of putting it. I've been known to be a bit ruder. It then took me 3 months to sit and meditate on this thing and think about it. And I realised at that point, hang on a minute, that was a major point in my belief and thinking of my art. I don't want to make art that people really like. I like to make art that makes people think or confronts people.
Mm-hmm.
So if I make chocolate box art, people are still thinking, I really like that. How much is it? 100 quid? I have that. But if they talk like that. But I want to challenge people. If people don't feel challenged by my work, then I'm not creating something that's creating a gut response. Gut responses is important. It's having the confidence It's good salesmanship.
Tell me, I want to pick up on something that you said there about the idea of when people receive and see and kind of interact with your art, that idea of then perhaps feeling a bit uncomfortable and questioning, and it kind of challenges their thinking. Is there something that's kind of quite deep down? Because people might say that some of your artwork can be quite dark, can't it? Whether is that something that is a way that you're expressing? Perhaps you say there for many years you felt like you were kind of dividing yourself, and there was a challenge within you. Does that come out in your artwork? It is essentially a bit of you.
Yeah, I mean, everyone says I'm dark. I don't see myself as dark. I see myself full of colour.
Mm-hmm.
My art is dark because it's printed with black ink. I see everything very monochromatic now, art-wise. I've been printing and doing woodcut blocks for nearly the last 10-something years. So when I do my artwork, I think in black and white. I try and change the black and white into colour. Yes, my work's dark because I'm appropriating images, or I'm using images that make people uncomfortable in the sense that they don't know what to think.
Mm.
You know, my work's based on folk traditions, folk art, that idea of putting a mask on, guising, becoming something else. You know, you may see monsters within there, but they're not monsters, they're people dressed up. But these things go on in Europe. I can do an exhibition, and I can put all my work up, and someone could walk in and go, wow, it's all black and white. When I look at it, I see all the colours. It's very odd.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of the eyes are empty. There's no eyeballs, or there's no irises. The irises are somewhere else within the work. I'm putting things in there that just disturb you that little bit, that you don't know what it is. The idea of printing the image, creating the image as I see it, but printing it for me in reverse, is me twisting myself up and messing myself about, because if I don't do that, I just get bored. I think it's playing with people, playing with people's emotions.
Mm.
And again, that was a moment in my life where I thought, fuck it, I show my work, I exhibit my work, people think I'm a digital printer, people come up and say, oh, is that silkscreened, or is that done on a computer? At which point I thought, fuck it, I've got to set up a Facebook page. And I hated the whole idea of Facebook. I didn't want to be part of that conformity or whatever. I set up this Facebook page, which is on my world. From that came Instagram. And Instagram, I think I'm more sliding to the world of Instagram than Facebook now. It's easier to look at.
Mm.
But again, it's that thing that people around the world have seen my work. Funniest thing is that the people that follow me are either tattooists or Russians. I don't know why I've got a lot of Russians following me. I don't mind the Russians following me. I think they get my sensibility, the European sensibility of, like, you know. But
it's taking you to a different place that maybe you hadn't seen then.
Yeah.
Actually, for finally understand you.
I think that's what it is. And the fact that young people are starting to get back into folk music, or the idea of Morris dancing, or, you know, computers have taken over, everything's become polished, and quite a few people are saying, I don't want to be part of that. I want to be able to go back to the roots of stuff. I want to create stuff with my hands. I want to do this. I've always said that. I've always stuck to this idea that I'm an artist, but I work in a craft situation. I like the vernacular. I like the country. I like the idea of, you know, people making things and that sort of, like, lopsided crookedness. Sometimes I can't bring it into my work because I'm too much of a perfectionist due to my star sign, which is Virgo. Thank you very much. But we are now at this point where people are saying, hang on a minute, about how many years ago? I think it was 6 or 7 years ago. I started looking into the world of Morris dancing. As a kid, I remember seeing Morris dancers and really loving that idea. Some people would go, what, Jeff, you're into Morris dancing? People in white suits with jingly bells? And I started looking into it and thinking, well, hang on a minute, there's a whole pageant of things here. There's a whole load of imagery. Through that, it then led on to my love of masks. Masks have always played a part in my life, whether I've realised it or not. From an early age, I collected Toby jugs. How many people collect Toby jugs? I don't know. I like the grotesque. Some of my earliest big murals were based on masks. When I was in my band, I wore masks because it was a way of disguising myself. I didn't want people to know who I am. You know, for many years, I've had a beard, and I fully appreciate that my beard is my mask. It's my barrier between me and the world.
Mm.
You can't see all my face. You can see my eyes. You can see what's going on. But really,
it's a layer of protection.
It's a layer of protection. I'm not a hipster. I don't think I'm a hipster. I just had my beard when hipsters were about. But I was actually waxing my moustache many years before that.
Now, there's a statement there.
Yeah, no, I was waxing my moustache in the days when I was living in London.
Yeah, there's a few women that could say that too.
In those days, I didn't have wax; it was Pritt stick. But you know,
how did it come around that you ended up in Switzerland then?
Okay, my wife started working for a company which was bought out by a very large company, and she came and said to me, Jeff, being told that if I want to progress within this business, you know, I need to be interviewed and maybe think about going to Switzerland. What do you think about it? And I said, that's great. I'll get my bags packed now. Because I realised, hang on a minute, Switzerland, that's where my chisels come from that I make for my, use for my woodcuts. So I was thinking on a totally different level to everyone else. And we'd gone through 3 years of breast cancer. It pushed us about quite a bit, and I also thought, fuck it, it's a chance to go and restart life and try and get things back.
So at this stage, had she been given all clear, or what was
the
stage?
She'd been told, Tara had been told she was in remission at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's sort of saying to you, but what if the worst happens? What if this happens? And I was saying, well, if we don't go up and live there, then we never know, and we could forever feel, why didn't we do it? We had this chance. Mm. This chance is only given to you once in a life. So we moved lock, stock and barrel to Switzerland. The first few months were pretty bad. I ended up breaking my foot whilst leaving England. 6 weeks later, I had an operation on my back because I'd slipped a disc. 3 months after that, my wife has pains. Tara has pains. She gets told she's got the cancer had started up again, but this time it was a lot more serious. I moped around the place in a fog. And then we finally came back to Manchester for a holiday. At which point, when I went back to Switzerland, I thought, I can't carry on like this. I need to pull myself up. For me, for my family, I need to pull myself up and say, right, I've realised why I wanted to leave England. What I've got here is great. And I started to integrate, rightly or wrongly. And I don't know, I find that I attract friends or attract people. I don't know why, it's just one of those things. I think it's because I'm interested in people most of the time.
Mm.
I integrated, and then I ended up having an exhibition in Switzerland and being told my prices were too cheap, so I put the prices up and sold work, and I was selling work for 3 times more than I sell it price here.
Mm.
But unfortunately, I had to come back to England, at which point I then decided I was going to buy a horse's skull and make my friend Dobbin, who's a mama's horse, and got to know quite a lot of main players in the world of Morris dance and folklore. And yeah, these are all moments in your life where you just think, I think that's what fuck it moments are. They come as moments in your life when you're stood on a cliff's edge. You can either fall backwards into what you had, or you can say fuck it and jump. And you may hit the ground running, or you may hit the ground and hurt yourself, but the fact is you said, I'm going to jump and I'm going to see what happens. If you don't jump in life, how do you know what's going to happen? I know I'm not going to fly. I know I'm going to be like Icarus. I know I'm going to hit the ground with a thud. But it's good. It's cathartic. Sometimes when you hit the ground with a thud, it's more of a thud than you expected, and that can change your life.
I think what's interesting about your scenarios, Jeff, is that some of the moments where you've had to snap your fingers and change, they've not always been your choice as well. And that's an interesting element in that sometimes things happen out of our control and then we have to learn to deal with it. I mean, we talked as well about the kind of imperfections of life, that life can be quite ugly when it's real. And those moments when you go through, your wife has breast cancer, you fight it, and then it comes back again, is an ugly time in life.
It's a very ugly time.
How does it impact you?
I had to put different masks on for different people. You know, I would, every Friday when I lived in Switzerland, I'd go down to a brewery that was below where I lived. I mean, some people say it's heaven. I had a brewery where I met people. It was cheap beer. There was hundreds of Swiss people. I had to put a mask on of this guy from Manchester who's a bit like, oh, who got very drunk very quickly. But I had to wear masks with people for different situations. To a point that it's part of who we are. I would say that I was lost for many years. I think that post my wife's passing, we're now going on to 4 months, four, 5 months, four. It's almost as if I'm shedding my skin on a daily basis. All these layers have been shedded and I'm slowly becoming me again in a way. I'm slowly becoming this happy-go-lucky fella. Yes, there's a lot of stress. Yes, I have to go see solicitors and I have to go to financial advisors.
And you've got a daughter who needs to look after.
Yeah, but all my fears and all my worries are slowly being ironed out. Why should I stop saying say to myself, you can't have nice things in life. You have to accept second best or whatever.
The term I like to use is about giving ourselves permission, because quite often we can kind of conform, I think you used that word before, where we do things because that's the way it should be done, or that's what we do, or that's what society or culture tells us the way that we should be. But actually, sometimes, whether people are a mother, a grandma, a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, whatever it is, when we give ourselves permission to do whatever it is that we want. I mean, for many years, when I didn't have a permanent job, and the irony now that I don't have a permanent job, and I'm okay with this, but for many years, I never gave myself permission to have a holiday. And I think it was probably like about 5 years where I didn't really have a break. Any holiday that I had, I would go and work for somebody else to shadow and gain experience. And of course, you don't have to be a genius to know what happens. You burn out. But when I suddenly realised and thought, well, it's not really about money or time. The money's there. And even if it was 2 days in a place I'd never been to, it's about this element. When we give ourselves permission, it opens ourselves up to much more opportunities.
I think we have to. I think that having been, how can I say this without sounding bad, but having been suppressed for so long.
Well, you put your life on pause, didn't you?
I put my life on total pause. You know, and I think I've said, I took the decision out some time ago to opt out of society in some ways. I don't really know what's going on in the world. I don't really have much interest. When you've got everything going on in your world, that's all you can focus on at one point.
Mm.
I took the decision that I will look after my wife and that I will look after my daughter and that I'm there for them as and when.
Well, it's also, there's a realisation of why are you doing certain things, and actually to have this freedom, if that's the right word, back, and you a chance to rediscover what it is a fuck it moment, because it's...
Oh, it is. It's daunting. Again, there's that cliff face again. It's daunting because you wake up every day. I've always had this belief that every day is an adventure. You don't know what that adventure is going to bring. It can bring you good times. It can bring you bad times. But if you have this belief that every day is an adventure, it makes life worth living.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, you know, you end up in the humdrum of everyday life. The adventure could be that you jump in your car, you go to work, but on the way to work, you take a detour down a road you've never been to. And the GPS will always get you back to the main road. But that's the adventure. The adventure, we all have to deal ourselves curveballs. We all have to deal ourselves these moments where we say, what was it? It's okay to do it. Give ourselves permission. If we don't give ourselves permission, then we just become automatrons. Does everyone want to be an automatron? I don't want to be an automatron.
Mm.
I don't want to be that person that gets wound up and then, you know, the spring's going slowly or whatever and you're shaking about the place.
Mm.
No, I want to be able to have some excitement. The excitement has to be there. Having had moments of excitement, but really everything was on hold, everything was suppressed, everything was pushed down. To be able to have it come back is a daunting thing sometimes. I think I spent the first month going, oh, I don't want to get out of bed. I've never been one of those people. I'm usually up at the crack of dawn. I used to be one of those people that'd be up straight away 2 or 3 hours in the studio before I go to work. Now, I get up and get my daughter ready, and then I realise, well, I have to bring something back into my life. And I brought back into my life that I go and sit in a coffee shop. I never felt comfortable doing my artwork in public.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, if I sit at home, I'm just going to get maudlin. Right, I need to put myself in an uncomfortable situation to make me feel alive. My uncomfortable situation was I found a coffee shop in Altrincham that I like going to. I have my space at a table. I think I'm going to get them a blue plaque and put it on the wall and have it say, this is where Jeff Knopf sits, and anyone else who sits here from before 8 o'clock will get kicked out. But that's my seat. I like sitting there. It's in the window so I can see everything that's going on around me. I see people as they come into the shop.
Mm.
I earwig into people's conversations and then add my penn'orth to it. I sit there and I draw. I draw a picture every day, and then I put that photo onto Instagram with a picture of the coffee with it. I think that's quite a cathartic thing to do, to say, okay, I'm going to put myself there. I'm in a raw situation, but I'm going to put myself out there because I could close the doors around me. I could say that's it. I met yourself.
That's how we met, but ironically, you weren't sat at your chair, were you?
I wasn't.
Just think, if someone was sat in Jeff's chair, if they hadn't sat there, we wouldn't have met. We wouldn't be having this conversation.
Of course. And I again, that was a moment where, oh, where do I sit? And I saw the end of the table. I thought, you know what?
I'm not that scary looking.
That person, she looks like a businesswoman. She's on a computer because that's what it looks like when people are on the computer.
It's my mask.
I'll sit here. I'll do my drawing. I'll get some food. And I think you broke the silence by passing me a cactus and saying, well, you could put that on your food instead of the salt and pepper. But that's how things happen. I think that, you know, things happen... Okay. I also believe things happen for a reason, and people meet people for a reason. We never know what that reason is, and a lot of my friends and a lot of people I've met for a reason. And then what I find out is that these people are connected to me. Maybe I'm, what's his name, Kevin Bacon. Everyone's connected to me one way or another. But that's how my life has been for many, many years. Even my late wife, Tara, it turned out that why we had never met, we were circling each other for such a period of time. She had friendships with friends of mine that I wouldn't even put into her social stratosphere. You know, and I find that everyone's connected one way or another. And friendships are like that. Again, it's having that courage to turn around to someone and say, how are you doing?
Mm.
Or, oh yeah, I was listening to what you were saying, and have you thought of it this way? Some people must think, well, who's that lunatic or that fairly crazed, caffeine-induced, crazed-eyed guy at the end of the table who's drawing and getting ink all over himself and things like that.
With that dark image.
I don't like it. I can't look at it. Please, don't make it come in front of my eyes. I can't stand it. But I think there's a lot of stuff that's destined for me in some ways. And I just need to find the way to tap into everything now and just say, this is it.
It's you know, the idea of connections as well. For many years, I've had this philosophy where I used to get really upset, you know, when a friendship that had kind of been going for a long time, you know, someone might have kind of betrayed me, or it just drifted. Quite often as you get older, things can drift, can't they? And yep. I found that really difficult. And then I kind of switched my thinking, and I can't remember where I heard it, but it was this idea about connections kind of come and go, and a door opens and the door closes. And it was a lot more of a kind of, I don't know, a scientific or strategic way of thinking about the people who you connect with in life. And sometimes those people just, you know, disappear. Oh, yeah. And that's how it is. But a big part of connecting, you know, I'm doing a project about social isolation and loneliness at the moment, and everything that has pointed in the evidence of how we progress in life, how we keep going, how we age better, is about how we connect to not just the close circle, but also the outer circle.
Yeah. I mean, you're saying about social isolation and loneliness. I think that at many points in my life, or, you know, when I lived in London, I was very lonely. You can be in the biggest city in the world and you can be lonely.
Mm.
Through the illness of cancer, I became very lonely. My wife was, Tara was focused on survival and anything that could come along that could keep her going. And when you have different views, that can be lonely. Being in Switzerland, there were times when I was lonely. But it's funny, connections, as I said, people come into your life for certain reasons or certain points. They come to shake you up. They can be fuck it moments.
Mm.
Meeting someone for that one moment, and all of a sudden you're empowered, and it's like, wow.
Or inspired.
You're inspired. Mm. And some of these friendships can be like fast burning. They can be like, well, those birthday candles you get, you light it, and all of a sudden it's out, and it's melted wax on your birthday cake. And it can spark, and it can be intense, and it can be for like so many months, this intense friendship. And then it can dissipate. Again, with my artwork, I call my art my friends. Here's a new friend. Here's a new friend. This is a new friend. It's like the most intense love affair in some ways. You have this germination of an idea. You draw it down. It comes, it blossoms. You create it. I work with wood blocks, so I draw it, I cut it, I spend days, weeks working on this thing. My love affair ends with it once I've done the final process, which is, well, once the final process is the printing. Once the printing's done, the print's then hung up to dry. Once it's dry, and I've additioned it, that's the end of my love affair. It gets folded up into paper and put in a drawer until it's called upon. The love affair's over because I can't look at it anymore.
Mm. You move to the next thing.
I've moved to the next thing.
But is that not quite ironic? When you think about this on a kind of bigger level, you talked, say, when Tara was ill, about kind of feeling quite emasculated and you're not being able to fix things. But here is something that, as a man, you can create, you can build, you can fix, which sometimes you don't often get that choice in life, do you? When
you don't.
You just have to kind of take whatever things are given to you.
I think that the creative force is almost like giving... These are my children. These are my thoughts. These are my everything. You can look at that work and you can see different emotions. My latest stuff, you can see I'm in a happier place. My friends have all said to me, wow, this is the most wonderful work. It's decorative. It's this. What are you going to do with it all? And they're all just sketches in a sketchbook. I love each one in a different way. Mm. Does that make sense? I'm getting all emotional about this now.
Because you get, it's a process, and you, and just like a bricklayer creates a wall, there is a physicality, I suppose, to when we express ourselves. And it's interesting because I don't think, well, maybe I'm wrong here, but people talk about, you know, a housing surveyor, a bricklayer, an accountant. They feel like very tangible jobs, which doesn't sound like there's lots of room for creativity. But when you are doing, and I find this with my audio as well. We talked a little bit earlier about I can cut a mix or cut something to sound in a certain way, but somebody else listens to it and interprets it in a completely different way. And that's really difficult.
I think everyone's an artist.
Hmm.
I believe everyone's an artist. You are an artist in what you do. Yes, you may not be able to draw. Art isn't about drawing. Art is about doing something. It is magic. I think Alan Moore said that artists are magicians. We create something from nothing. But people that work with numbers are, to me, are magicians. I can't think like that. People that build walls, bricklayers, they're artists. They have an artistic streak that they can create this. Art is within us all. We just have to realise or channel it to the way that we want it to be channeled. Coming back to friendships, that's what it is. It's being, everything fires. And connections as well.
So in a world of your mind, no one is a stranger.
No one's a stranger because it all becomes connected. Even yourself.
Yeah.
It turns out that you know people that I know that we've and have been going on about and blah, blah, blah. Is that crazy?
No, I agree massively. And like just meeting that one person can suddenly shoot off and
of course
you never really know. And I think it's very interesting when you decide to create a blank canvas, as you know I did a few months ago when I decided I don't want to work in, on a permanent job anymore. I'm going to set up my own business and I'm going to do this and start again and I want to reshape my life how it is. And the first thing that is always good to do is to go out, talk to people, hear what they're saying, hear what they're doing, and connect with life.
I think that's what we have to do.
Yeah.
I think too many people walk around with blinkers.
Yeah.
And you become very closed. And I think, really, it's about opening your eyes to things around you.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of that fuck it situation. You open your eyes, take the blinkers off, and just say, yeah.
Well, the phrase is say yes to your universe. That's the
is that what it is?
That's the very cheesy thing. Yeah.
I've never, well, maybe I do have to say yes to my universe.
You've got to be open and willing to accept what is in front of you.
Yeah.
There was a message that you sent me last week and you'd said that you'd been thinking about our conversation and you know, the first time that we met and the things that we talked about, where I first introduced you the idea of why I wanted to start doing the Fuck It Moments podcast. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, it just changed my view.
Hmm.
It changed my view in the sense that, hang on a minute, the only way I can get on with life is to say fuck it to a lot of things. Fuck it to what I've been dealt. You know.
Did it give you a sense of empowering yourself?
Yes.
Against something of which you had to go along with and there was nothing that you could about?
Yeah, it gave me that empowerment because it's that other thing's finished. I knew for ages that I had a ticket. The only way I can describe what I had a ticket to was I had a ticket to something, a front row ticket to a show that I really didn't want to watch. I couldn't get rid of that ticket. It's something that I had to face. I had to face watching my wife of 45 die in front of me. And that's quite a life-changing moment, watching someone take the last breath, holding the hand. Everything around you, you realise life and death, well, birth is very much like death in this situation. There's hospital intervention, there's doctors, there's nursing, there's screaming, there's shouting, there's swearing, there's all sorts of things going on. You have no control. That point is totally controlless. How can you go on from that point? That point is really quite raw. And you either go backwards and you think about it every day. And for many weeks and days, I'd have the final vision of my wife's face in my head. You can go on with that, but at a certain point you have to say, fuck it, I can't go on like this. I think I've said this before. You have to say, this is upsetting me, this is making my life a mess. I can't carry this baggage anymore. I have to be able to cast it out there. So I had my conversation with you, and I started thinking about this fuck it stuff and thinking, yeah, there's many times in my life where I've had these fuck it moments where I think a fuck it moment is taking control, taking it back for yourself. Hence the New Year's Eve. I could have stayed at home, but no, I thought, fuck it, I'll go out with these people to this party that I don't know who the people are. I'll eat their sushi, I'll drink their alcohol. I'll then walk out with these guys at the end of the party. I'll dance around like a loon. We'll let off fireworks in someone's garden that I do know. And the firework didn't shoot off into the sky. It exploded across the street. It was the most fantastic sight. And as I said, I was then lying in the hot tub looking at the stars. And I said at that point, fuck it, no more. Can't do this. I can't do this to myself. I'm killing myself emotionally. I have to pull myself up. I have to get myself back to that point where I'm strong again, where I'm a person, where I'm a human being. A human being, because I felt like I've been living in the land of the living and the dead. Walking down this path, sharing my wife with Hades every 3 months. Every 3 months it'd be like back to the gates of hell, back to the gates of whatever. I need life again. I need excitement. I need to feel human. The only way to make that happen is to say, fuck it. I can do this. I have to have the inner strength to do this. Some people may think his wife's only been gone 4 months, 3 months. What they don't realise, these people, is that they've never had this. Sorry. they've never had this. Until you've been in my shoes, walked my path, seen what I've seen, until you've been there, how can you tell me your pearls of wisdom? That's rubbish.
So the future for you is essentially giving yourself permission to live again.
Yeah. The future for me is to give myself permission to live again, to do things out of the ordinary, to shake myself up, to give my daughter things that I didn't have or we haven't had for a long time. You know, cooking her food that she loves. Having the pleasure of cooking again became a point where cooking was something that I hated because it wasn't right, or this wasn't right, or that wasn't right. Have the permission to go, you know what? I want to go to Madrid. I've always wanted to go to Madrid. I was supposed to go to Madrid. I want to go look at Guernica. I want to go look at the Goyas because they're dark and brooding. I want to see the El Grecos. I really do want to go and see Velázquez's Las Meninas. I want to see these things. I've seen them in books. I've seen them in pictures. So the other day, I was at my friend's house, and my friend's also just lost his wife to cancer, but a different cancer. And my parents sent me a thing saying, we know you want to go to Madrid. Look, there's this deal. So I said to my friend, I said, should we book and go to Madrid together? Leave the kids here. Don't care who they go with. We need a break. Because we need to find ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to do. Yes, I want to go to Mexico. I want to go to Mexico. I don't know what's drawing me to Mexico. There's something... It's not because it's all on TV. I've had this belief for a while. There's something drawing me to that place, and at some point I will go to Mexico. But it's being able to stand up and say, I'm not going to sit there and say no anymore. I've watched my father and my mother be these like safe people. Oh, you can't do that because it might create this. Or... you know, I'm part of this community, this Jewish community that watches everything I do. If I had it my way, I'd run off and say, fuck you all. I can't. I've got a daughter who needs these people.
Mm.
But I just feel like saying, fuck it to everyone, because they watch my life, times your life. When you've got a serious illness within your family, it's almost as if your life is underneath a microscope, and that microscope is everyone around you watching you and watching every move that you make. I want to meet someone. I want to have a relationship. I want to have love again. I want to have closeness. I want to have tenderness. I want to have all these things that I shut off. If it happens now or tomorrow or next week or whatever, well, fuck you. Who are you to tell me that this isn't long enough or that isn't long enough? No, this is... And that's what fuck it is. It's that spark, isn't it? It's that bit that just goes, you know what, I'm a mischievous fucker. I'll just say fuck it.
I've launched something within you that...
Yeah, you've empowered something. you've relaunched that spark that was... I always did things... But you've relaunched this thing within me that's just like, yeah, I want to go to synagogue in a pair of denims and a Breton top and a shit jacket and say, well, I'm not here. You know, it's not about what you wear. It's about being here.
Mm.
I could do it in Switzerland, but in England, Manchester, in Hale. Can't do that.
You know, I think that's it. These mischievous moments of my life have always been there.
Well, I think it's fair to say that you have an unconditional, everlasting membership of the Fuck It Moments membership club, shall we say. Just tell me in a sentence, what will 2018 look like for you?
Exciting. New. New improved. I don't know, 2018. There's a lot more stuff to sort out, but 2018 is the rebirth. The shedding of old skins, the coming back of me. Well, if you don't like it, fuck it.
The Fuck It Moments podcast is brought to you by the consultancy ASFB Productions. It's hosted by me, Claire Freeman. The music is by Thomas Ragsdale. Thanks to Gareth Price at philandgarth.com for the cover art, and Chris Hughes at Oscillate Recordings for some studio time. You can find Jeffrey Knopf on Facebook and Instagram. See some of his art that he's been up to on there. Next time, Bethan hadn't met Mr. Wright at 40, but she decided she wanted to be a mom anyway. She guides us through the process of how she became a single adopter to two siblings in the last few years. You can find us in all the usual places on social media, hashtag FimPod. And whatever decision you're pondering over, or if you've just come out the other side, share your story with me. Email me, fimpod@gmail.com.